Well, a big thank you to the two Johnnies for keeping us entertained this afternoon. It is Thursday, June 15th. I am Shane Dawson and you're listening to Game On. Coming up this evening, it is match day minus one to Ireland's huge Euro 2024 qualifier in Athens. We'll hear from the Irish camp and Alan Cawley is in studio to give us his starting 11 to face Greece. In our women's football slot, Rebecca Cray sets us up for kickoff in the All-Ireland Cup. While in golf, we're live to LA Country Club for day one of the US Open with Greg Allen. And sticking stateside, we've Jeff Shepherd on how Arsenal owner Stan Kroenke has added the NBA title to his recent wins in the Super Bowl and Stanley Cup. If you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet us at Game On 2FM.
Game On 2FM.
Yes, hello there. Good evening. Alan Cawley is in studio. Alan, fair play. I say this every day when people are coming in this week. You know, you're giving up a bit of time in the sun to come in and chat a bit of sports. So,
Shane, I'm Game On loyal.
Yeah.
I am Game On loyal.
This is the man who gave up the five-a-side with the former Ireland internationals
I'm
and everything.
I'm a veteran of Game On at this stage, Shane. You know, so I've been there from day one. So sunshine, hail, rain or snow, I'm here.
Not a fair weather Game Onner. I'm merely a blow-in compared to you, Alan. Okay, you're going to be sticking around because we're going to be chatting football and plenty more besides. But let us first just cross to Greg Allen, who was live at the Los Angeles Country Club on day one of the US Open. Greg, we previewed all the action yesterday. It has begun today. There are a couple of Irish interest out on course at the moment. What is the latest?
Well, the latest actually is Shane Larry's out there on a gloomy grey day, which probably isn't all that different to what a gloomy grey day is like in Ireland. It's a bit of mist in the air as well, so temperatures high 60s Fahrenheit, sort of 20 or thereabouts degrees centigrade. So it's a fairly familiar Irish type of temperatures and conditions, which you don't really expect in summer in Los Angeles. And Shane Larry doing really very well. He's had a very erratic eight holes that he's played so far, three bogeys, but three birdies and just two pars. Opened up with a drive which went into the right-hand rough, Bermuda rough, not the type of place you want to be, but he did well to advance the ball to within about 120 yards of the flag, and then he played a beautiful wedge shot into about 5 feet to hold the putt for an opening birdie on the par five. Well, a fairly, you know, easy par five to start off with, but birdieing at the first hole is always a good thing when you face the second hole, which is one of the toughest holes in the course. He bogeyed the second, but then hit a wedge shot to 3 feet in the third, so he's well up and running, and he's managed to withstand a couple of pretty bad bogeys, because the sixth and seventh hole, certainly the sixth hole is a fairly easy par four, the seventh is a tough par three. He bogeyed both of those, but then bounced back with birdie on the eighth. So birdie, bogey, that type of round so far. Shane Larry, though, settled into his US Open task, level par after eight, and there's nothing wrong with level par in the US Open, as historically we know. At the moment, he's tied for 17th place of the 78 players on the golf course. So Larry, the best of the Irish so far. Seamus Power, one over par after four, and Matthew McLean, the optometrist, the amateur from Belfast, the winner of the US Mid-Amateur Championship last year, which is a tournament for players over 25 years of age. The winner of that gets into the US Open. That's one of the big prizes. And Matt McLean enjoying his opening pretty well, one over par after four. Nothing wrong with that when you consider that players like Justin Thomas are three over after eight, Colin Morikawa two over after five, and Victor Hovland, who these days is one of the hottest players in majors, three over after five. John Rahm, incidentally, the world number two, is level of par after five, and Scotty Scheffler, one over par after five. So, as you can see from that, Shane Lowry on level par through eight holes, going quite nicely. And not a lot of very big names at the top of the leaderboard. Jacob Solomon and Dylan Roo, two American professionals, they are three under par, both starting their back nines. Ricky Fowler, though, has joined that group in the lead on three under par with a birdie on the seventh a few minutes ago. And Xander Schauffele, one of the most consistent players in the US Open over the last 5 years, he is three under par after six. So Schauffele, Fowler, Wu and Solomon, the joint leaders on three under par. Later on we'll see Rory McIlroy and Patrick Harrington on the course, but for now Shane Lowry going nicely, level par after eight. Seamus Power one over after four, and Matt McLean one over after four.
Greg, we chatted yesterday about off-course distractions with the merger and so on and so forth. I did see a tweet from Doug Ferguson, who was on with you yesterday, who said, now, a humorous tweet, I must say, Max Homa sinked a five-foot putt on the first green despite a car honking from Wiltshire Boulevard in middle of a stroke. You wouldn't get that at Oakmount. How difficult are the conditions there, Greg, by the sounds of that tweet?
you know, it is amazing how this piece of land, it's about 300 acres or more of land, is parked right in the center of Los Angeles, urban Los Angeles. We're on Wilshire Boulevard here, the Beverly Hilton, you know, home of the Golden Globes, is literally behind the first screen. You know, it's extraordinary. The Playboy Mansion, by the way, is by the 14th tee. So we're like, we're in the heart of Los Angeles, and yet this course is unique. I think it was built here more than 100 years ago, 126 years ago, when this was all kind of open land, and Los Angeles is basically encroached around it. So it's a very interesting golf course, huge elevation changes, a ravine which goes through the middle of it. So it's very, very interesting and quite beautiful in places. But all around it are skyscrapers, and it's more like downtown Hong Kong. You know, the Hong Kong Open is staged on a golf course pretty much downtown, and this is the same here. But it's a terrific golf course. It has a look of it, which I think as the week goes on and the sun comes out, which hopefully it will, and it'll brown up the golf course a bit, and the course will get a bit firmer and much, much more difficult, I think, as the weekend goes on, because we've got temperatures rising through the weekend. Then I think we're going to see the real US Open.
Okay, my final tangent, Greg, and I'll let you go now because I know you'll be checking in later with us. You mentioned the Bermuda rough, and for anyone who's on Twitter, I implore you to get onto Greg Allen's Twitter. He put a picture up of the Bermuda rough, and Greg, you were saying the Venus flytrap of golf course grasses. I mean, I've never seen a ball just sink in like that before.
Yeah, the rough here is non-indigenous. It's not, you know, the grass that normally grows in this part of the world, but they brought it in for the golf course here, and it really is like Venus flytrap, if anybody knows it. Like, the grass just gobbles the ball, but that's if the ball goes to the bottom of the grass. If there's enough of it, the ball can actually sit up on top of it, and then you're okay. But if the ball plugs into this grass here in the rough, you are taking your, you know, most alleviating wedge out of the bag just to hack it out into play. But then again, the fairways on average are 43 yards wide. So if you miss them, maybe you deserve to be in a bad, typical US Open lie. But there are good lies out there, but there are awful lies out there. And just as I'm speaking, John Rahm has birdied the sixth hole, and he's gone to one under par, who incidentally, also on six under par, or one under par through seven holes, is his countryman, Sergio Garcia.
Brilliant. Well, listen, Greg, we'll leave it there. We'll be checking in with you before 7 o'clock to see the latest from the US Open. Greg Allen, thank you very much. In a golf football crossover, news today that Ricky Fowler has revealed he is one of three top US golfers looking to invest in Leeds United as part of its imminent takeover by 49ers Enterprises. The American Investment Group have agreed a £170 million deal to buy out chairman Andrea Ziani's controlling stake. Fowler is being joined by US Ryder Cup teammates Jordan Spieth and Justin Thomas as fellow investors. Apparently the US trio have been converted to becoming Leeds fans by English golfer Matt Fitzpatrick's caddy Billy Foster, who is from Yorkshire. And I did enjoy the quote from Ricky Fowler: it's cool to have these opportunities, it would be fun if we get to be part of it, if not we'll continue to root for Leeds. Obviously they got relegated, but to get to a Premier League game, a Champions League game, any of that would be great. It's a massive sport, and I feel like it's continuing to get bigger in the States. I feel that the heart's not quite there, judging by those comments. I'm not sure.
Lads with too much money and don't know what to spend,
like,
it on.
It'd be great to get like, I want to see them going to like the Championship, you know, doing a Tuesday night in Rotherham or something.
Millwall. That'll sort them out, Shane. But it's obviously they must have been following the whole Wrexham Ryan Reynolds story as well. And I'd rather have these takeovers than some of the ones we're seeing at the moment, Shane, to be honest. But even following the golf documentary on Netflix, those lads are big buddies, and it's great to see even Greg mention Ricky Fowler is 3 under par, because there was a period in golf, Shane, when, you know, I'm a big fan of golf, especially the majors, and I always had a flutter on Fowler every tournament, regardless of what form he was in, what form he wasn't in. I always felt, because he was one of those almost like Jimmy White in the snooker, a bit like the people's
champion. He was your banker.
A bit like the people's champion. People really liked him. He used to wear the orange gear on the Sunday, and he was one of those everybody thought, well, he'll definitely win a major at some point. And of course, he's gone downhill massively in the last couple of years. But there's been a bit of a resurgence over the past 6 months, and now obviously in this major, and I haven't got the flutter on this time. so I'd be devastated if he wins, never mind the Leeds takeover. But it is good to see him back, and he is big buddies with Spieth and Thomas, so I think that's a good thing.
We'll be interested to see how it goes. It's gone relatively well for Wrexham and whatnot.
Yeah.
Ben Foster, I think, was on a podcast talking about the whole team were brought over to Las Vegas, all expenses paid. So
Yeah, listen, they seem fairly genuine, those lads, to be fair.
I know they do.
And
they
as
do.
I said, when it's a hot topic at the moment, takeovers in football for the wrong reasons. But I think that one, I'd be happy with that kind of one.
Well, there's a certain club in Dublin hopefully riding the crest of a Turkish wave soon enough, so we shall see. Alan, you're going to stick around because we're going to get into the nuts and bolts of football. Rebecca Cray will be joining as well, so stick with us here in Game On.
RTE 2FM.
Game On.
Football.
Now, you're very welcome back to Game On as we chat football. Alan Cawley, we're going to chat football. I'm putting a ban on any Love Island talk because that has been in the headlines today before we dive into the small matter of Greece and Republic of Ireland tomorrow. So there is a former League of Ireland footballer that is entering the Love Island villa. I asked Paul Curry this the other day. He admitted he was. Are you a Love Island fan?
No. The early days, I watched a bit of it.
Yeah. I like their earlier stuff.
I wouldn't touch it now.
You're a Love Island hipster.
when it first came out, I suppose, the novelty of it. It's okay. Well worn off at this stage, yeah. Shane.
Well, Scott van der Sluis, formerly of Shelburne, is heading in. And I bring it up because I just do want to put a bit of context on former League of Ireland footballer. Hasn't played a league game. He played one FAI Cup game, a couple of Leinster Senior Cups. But we wish him all the best and hopefully he does well. In footballing matters then, Greece, Republic of Ireland tomorrow. Commentary live on Game On 2FM with John Kenny and Kenny Cunningham in an extended Game On tomorrow. I did mention yesterday we're continuing our qualifying campaign. It started against France. It was a positive performance, plenty of positives to take from it. What are you hoping to see from Ireland tomorrow evening in terms of a 90-minute performance?
Yeah, well, I think we're at the stage, Shane, where we've had some of the performances without the results. I think we're at the stage now where we need the results, and especially when, I suppose, the group is crammed in the nature that it is, that this game has come at a stage where obviously we've the Dutch game to follow, the French game as well, that we really need to pick up 3 points against Greece. Now, it's an unusual situation in the sense that you're facing opposition who are literally in the same kind of predicament as us, as you look at Netherlands and France, thinking that it's a must win for them also, because obviously we're looking to fight it out for that third place, that second at best. Like, France are going to obviously top the group, as we all kind of predicted at the start. Are we going to spring a surprise and overcome the Netherlands? Looking at Netherlands at the moment, obviously they had a bad defeat last night themselves. There's a bit of kind of turmoil going on there in the camp, it looks as though. So we could catch them on a good night, but it's all important that you beat Greece, because it's going to come down to those games, I feel, for Greece and for us. So that's why tomorrow is absolutely pivotal in the grand scheme of things. And as I said, we've had the 2 or 3 years with Stephen building the team. There's plenty of caps on the board now for a lot of those lads. The team nearly picks itself by 2 or 3 players, which I think is a good thing, because finally we're getting a bit of continuity in the team selection. There's a bit of strength and depth which probably hasn't been there in Stephen's earlier days. So we've done all the building as such, Shane. Now we're at the stage where the results matter so much. And you can use whatever phrase you want on Stephen's tenure so far in terms of the early days when there was COVID and there was excuses and there was injuries and all sorts of things. And I've always been for Stephen, but I do feel we're at a period now where we're going into this campaign. We want to be in the campaign with a chance come September, October time. We don't want to feel as though it's all over after just 2 games.
Yeah, well, it was interesting you mentioned how pivotal this game is. Tony O'Donoghue was on yesterday and spoke about really a minimum 4 points is needed from both the Greece match tomorrow and then Gibraltar on Monday. Stephen Kenny was on media duty today. The press conference was on, and the question was put to him, is this a must-win game?
Listen, from our point of view, you know, we're looking forward to the game. I think it's great that it's, you know, it's the first competitive game to the stadium. It's full house. That's, you want to be involved in games like that. I think we're looking for that, you know, historic away win. That's what we want. It's our objective to try and get that big away win. Greece have a very good home record and have been in good form over the last year, and we respect that. Nothing will be easy. We'll have to fight for everything, and it's only the second game in the group, so I don't think anything is decided so early. But we're certainly you know, we're certainly, it's certainly going to be an important game for both teams.
non-committal on whether it's a must win or not.
Like, yeah, and I think that's probably he's trying to deflect the fact that he doesn't want to heap too much pressure on the players going into the game. So that's fair, and I think Stephen was always probably going to say that, but I think deep down he probably feels as though, I don't mean must win as in if we were to draw and you win on Monday night, as you say, Shane, 4 points out of six, you're still very much in the group, but it just feels like these games against Greece are going to be so pivotal when it comes to obviously the bigger game against the Dutch. And we've no divine right to go away to any nation and win. Like, when you look at Stephen's record since he's come in, we've the four competitive wins that he has been against Armenia, Azerbaijan, Luxembourg, and that good win against Scotland. So as I say, like, it's not like we're looking at this thinking, oh, it's a must win and we'll go over there and we'll win comfortably or anything like that. It's going to be a really difficult game. And the same way as we're probably looking at Greece thinking it's an opportunity for us to pick up 3 points, they're looking at us the exact same way, and probably even more advantageous to them is the fact that they're at home. So they will definitely fancy their chances, and that might heap a little bit more pressure on them, Shane, in that regard. Whereas we're the away team, we can kind of, you can put a spin on picking up a point away from home. Whereas if Greece tomorrow night were only to pick up a point, they're the home team in this tie. It's two-legged tie, if you want to call it, for the two games that we play Greece. That's why the home game is so important, and I think there's probably a little bit more pressure on them in that regard. But they're a good side. Poyet has been playing very well since he's come in. They have the safety net of obviously the playoff as well, because they've come through the Nations League and topped the group. So in that regard, there's the little bit of safety net for them. But I think they'll want to go out in front of their own fans and put on a good performance as well, and view us basically as saying we will beat Ireland and then we'll take our chances against the Netherlands, the same way as we're kind of viewing them.
Are you confident?
I actually am, and I tell you why. Not confident in the sense that I think it's going to go over there and, as I say, we'll win comfortably or anything like that. It'll be a very difficult game. Do I fancy our chances? I do, and I tell you, because you look at the team now, as I said, Stephen has built up kind of a little bit of strength and depth. There's continuity in the selection of the team. I've picked an 11 for you, Shane, and we chatted about this earlier on, and 8 or 9 of them is easy to pick.
Let's go through 11. So starting with your defence, you've gone Bazunu, Doherty left wing back, Doherty right wing back, O'Dowda left wing back, Collins, Egan, O'Shea are your defenders. So does the defence pick itself, really? Yeah, considering Coleman's unavailable.
Like. Yeah, so obviously Seamus is unavailable. He played great against France, so I think Doherty will revert over to right wing back. Now, of course, there's a question mark about Matt at the moment because he hasn't played football, but I think Matt looks after himself very well. We've had the build up in terms of the pre-camp that they had in Bristol for the 4 days, and they've been in Turkey obviously for the last 10 days. So I think Matt will be fine for this game, and I think he'll start. O'Dowda will come in on the left hand side ahead of McLean because Stephen likes him, and of course he offers us that attack and threat going forward, predominantly a winger, but he can play in wing back where he's played with his club a lot this season as well. So
just on O'Dowda, actually, sorry to cut across you, but Stephen Kenny was asked specifically about Callum O'Dowda, because, you know, I suppose in theory he is our first choice left full now ahead of James McLean. So here's what Stephen Kenny had to say.
Yeah, I mean, good competition on left wing back. James McLean has been, you know, such longevity, and still one probably the fittest player in the squad, and got player of the year at his club this season, James McLean. Callum O'Dowda has also performed well in recent games, obviously scored against Latvia, hit the post against Malta coming on late, and had a good game against Norway overall. So he's come in, obviously injuries interrupted his international career, and he has adapted to being a left wing back. I've traditionally been a winger at his club, so he's become a left wing back. And so what qualities he can bring is that he can bring the qualities of a winger in that position. So he's a natural dribbler and can then go inside or outside. So he can give you a line to his speed. He can give you different qualities.
Very good at going forward. Would you be suspect defending?
Yeah, and I think that's what you get when you play wingers in those positions, Shane. But the fact that Stephen wants to play with the three centre halves and the wing backs, in this game as well, I think that's an advantage to us with the personnel available to play left wing back and right wing back, the two attack minded ones, because as I said, you're going out against the opposition who you'll fancy your chances of going out and taking on and creating chances, and we want to get the win, so we have to be attack minded. It was different against France. You could play Seamus and you could play Matt as wing backs who were predominantly full backs and offered that kind of defensive solidity. This is a completely different game where, as I said, we will hope to be on the front foot and attack, and the fact that Callum O'Dowden is a winger, first and foremost, I think he will offer a big threat on the left hand side, because he's a fit boy, strong boy, very physical. He can get up and down that left wing, no problem to him, and Stephen likes him as well, so I'm sure he's filling him with confidence. I even heard an interview with him there, was it last week, throughout the camp, and he was speaking about how comfortable he is in the camp amongst the group as well, that they've almost created this kind of club type atmosphere. So I think O'Dowd will play tomorrow and I think he'll do well.
Okay, Lenihan, is he far off from your three centre half?
Yeah, he is, because I watched that. He's had a great season with Middlesbrough. I know Shea hasn't played a lot recently as well, but I do like Daryl Shea. I love his attitude, I love his mentality. Both of them have, funny enough, played this time last year over in the Ukraine game, and I thought Lenihan, I think that might have been his first start, and he was absolutely brilliant. He was Daryl Lenihan, and he's had a great season, so it's a toss of a coin with them two, but I do like O'Shea. So that's why I've gone for him.
Okay.
But if Daryl Lennon was to start tomorrow, I'd have no issue with that whatsoever.
Is Bazunu nailed on, number one, like ahead of Kelleher?
So. Yeah. I think so, yeah. Just because he's played a lot more football. Now, I know he was left out towards the end at Southampton, but I think Stephen will be loyal to Bazunu. And again, I don't think he'll make the change, but it wouldn't bother me who's in goals. Yeah. I think the two of them are very good, but I think he'll stick with Bazunu.
Yeah, Mark Travers as well, linked with a move to Luton as well, since he's fallen out of favour at Bournemouth. So it'll be interesting to see if that does go through. And Matt Doherty, not much game time, but Atletico Madrid apparently looking at installing a Dublin training camps, academy camps, apparently. That, so it'll be interesting to see. Yeah, but the League of Ireland be happy with that.
The back three and the wing backs is fine. And even there, we've options. With there is a bit of strength and depth. So that's all fine, Shane.
Okay, let's move on to midfield then. You have a triangle, Will Smallbone at the top of the triangle, the more attacking threat, and then Josh Cullen and Jason Malumbi.
Yeah, because we'll play with the three in there. And obviously against France, they played Malumbi and Cullen, who are a mainstay of the team, have done really well, very much established now in that midfield. And Jason Knight is the other one who's obviously done very well. But I just think with this game, again, going back to the point about that we have to be on the front foot, we have to try and create chances, we have to score goals. I don't think Knight gives you that creativity. He gives you all the legs and energy in the world, which we will need at some point tomorrow. But I just don't think he has that spark in terms of, he's not bad at getting in the box and getting on the end of things, but I just want someone like Smallbone who can pick a pass, create a chance, create an opportunity. And I think he's had a brilliant season with Stoke. Again, Stephen likes him. He's obviously progressed through the under-21s, and I just think he gives you that little bit more X factor in that area of the pitch compared to Jason Knight. And because of the fact, again, I'm going back to the point about the opposition who we're trying to pick up 3 points against, I think we need someone like that in that area of the pitch, because against France, again, it was more a kind of a rear guard action where we had the three boys obviously doing a lot of work and basically protecting the back four or five against France, whereas we have to be on the front foot and try and go out and create chances. So I think Smallbone may start.
Okay, well, Will Smallbone looking to pick out a couple of passes, and one man looking to get on the end of those passes, Evan Ferguson. Before I get your thoughts on the attacking options here, Stephen Kenny, on the great man that is Evan Ferguson.
Evan's really emerged quicker than we could have anticipated, and he's done brilliant for Brighton in the Premier League, and you know, it's certainly we're delighted to have him. Is you know, he's trying really well this week, and he's such a young player that, you know, you certainly wouldn't want to put too much on his shoulders, because we've got you know, five good forwards in the, you know, in the squad. But he has got terrific ability, and we'd love to see that emerge over the next week for sure.
So unsurprisingly, Evan Ferguson is in your starting 11, but you've gone with Adam Eda instead of Michael Obafemi alongside him.
Yeah, I'm not mad on Obafemi, to be honest with you, Shane. I think he's hit and miss. He hasn't played a lot of football as well since he's made the move to Burnley. And now you could argue the same with Eda, but I think Stephen likes Eda, and I just think he'll offer more of a threat in behind, in terms of if we're looking to play a game where they're possession based as well, Greece, there could be lots of the game tomorrow night where we could be not so much penned in, but obviously you're trying to get out and break out from that kind of defensive
Are you not looking for that burst of pace then in Mikey Johnson and Obafemi?
Which I think Ida gives you that as well.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think he'll be fine in that regard. So there will be pace in terms of Adauda, Ida to run in behind. He's a good honest lad as well, Adam Ida. He's been obviously hampered with injury because when he burst on the scene, people, not so much like a Ferguson bursting on the scene, but I think there was a lot of hope and expectation. He's obviously been hampered with injury, so it's just kind of stalled that progression a little bit. But I just think he offers more in his all-round game than what Obafemi gives you. I know Obafemi did well in the Scotland game, but he's very hit and miss, Shane. And there's another game, what was the friendly match where I watched him and he offered nothing at all. So I just think he'll be a better foil either for Ferguson. And I'd love to see Stephen go with two up top tomorrow. And if that's Obafemi, fair enough, but I'd love to see him play with two up top and go for it. There's a lot of talk as well. Another option that he has is maybe play Ferguson on his own and play Jason Knight and Smallbone and have two kind of creative players behind Ferguson. But I think that's very, very difficult still for Evan because he's still up front isolated on his own, whereas I'd love to see him with a partner. And he's very good at that as well, in terms of he can drop in and let someone else run in behind, or if Smallbone wants to run in behind. I just think it gives us better options and it suits Evan's game better as well. So yeah, I'd love to see that. That's the team I'm going to go for. I think there's only probably two or three positions where there will be a question mark for Stephen. And
is Mikey Johnson anywhere near a starting 11?
He's probably close, but I don't think he'll start. I think he'll be an impact sub, to be honest with you. Because where do you play him? We don't play with wingers as such, so he's not going to play him as a left wing back. Could you potentially play him ahead of Smallbone behind the front man? Possibly, but I'm not sure. I think he could be a fella coming off the bench if we need a spark of life late in the day, because it's going to be hot as well tomorrow, Shane, so you will need lads off the bench. There's no doubt about that, but I do think 8 or 9 of it picks itself. The only probably question mark there, that decision Stephen probably has to make, is Lenehan or O'Shea or Ida or Obafemi, and Knight and Smallbone possibly.
And Bazunu Kelleher, I'm going with that. I'm team Kelleher.
You think there's a decision there, do you?
I think so. I'm team Kelleher. Yeah.
No, I'm actually.
I think he's a better goalkeeper.
I do too. Yeah. Funny enough, I've said this even last year when Bazunu was kind of. No, I think he's very good. It's not.
Oh yeah, I'm not talking down. Yeah. Like he's a brilliant smashing keeper. Yeah.
I think Kelleher's mentality. I think just. I'm not saying the other fella's mentality is not good. I just think Kelleher, in terms of the level that he's at and the club that he's at. And of course, the debate rages now around should he move. But I think he's fine where he is. But yeah, I'd have Keller ahead of him as well. But I think he'd play Bazunu.
Okay.
But it's a massive game, Shane. Even in terms of Stephen's tenure, it's absolutely massive. And as I said, we're at the stage now. We've had all the chats. We've had all the progression, the build-up, the building the team, the transitional period, all the phrases you want to put on it. I think we need to see results now.
Absolutely. Rebecca Cray joins us on the line as well. Rebecca, are you confident of Ireland's hopes in Athens tomorrow night?
Yeah, I'd be hopeful at the minute. I know, I think it's been a positive run in the last few months, you know, in the last year or so, with the kind of integration of the likes of Evan and Co coming in, you know. So yeah, I'm going to be positive.
Good, you're always positive. I don't think we've ever chatted to you, Rebecca.
Always.
You haven't been positive. So, well, listen, we'll be interested to see. As I mentioned, John Kenny, Kenny Cunningham are on comms duty on a very special extended game on tomorrow evening here on 2FM. Sticking with the national teams, I suppose. Rebecca, it's the first time you've been on since Vera Powell announced her pre-World Cup squad, albeit Katie McCabe, along with Denise O'Sullivan, Sinead Farrelly, Marissa Shiva and Aoife Mannion, who's been monitored with that injury, haven't been included. They'll link up with the team after the Zambia match. There's 27 players named. The final squad of 23 players will have to be named before we head to Australia and New Zealand for the World Cup. Overall, what's your general thoughts? Anyone unlucky not to be named in this provisional squad?
Yeah, I suppose the overall squad that was announced, you know, much of the same of the core group that was involved throughout the whole World Cup campaign. I think, which has been, you know, prolific throughout the whole of social media in recent days, is the absence of Jessie Stapleton. I think she's been quite unlucky. You know, I know we all say she's quite young. She probably has many years and hopefully many major tournaments ahead of her. But look, I think, I hope it's coming across as an unbiased opinion as well, being at Shell's head, but you know, she's been in great form in her senior football, you know, tenure in the last, 2 years. She's been involved and she does a great job, you know, centre-back, midfield. She even scores goals, you know. She's 5 goals currently with Shelburne this season, and all from a centre-back position, you know. So I'd be quite hard done by if I was Jessie Stapleton. Another shout is for Sive Doyle. I think she's been amazing, you know, in the league so far for P-Mount. She could have been in with a shout also, been very, very consistent, probably one of the more consistent in the league this season. So, yeah, look, I think if I was those two from a domestic standpoint, you know, be feeling a little bit hard done by, but they have the age on their side. Hopefully there's plenty more to come.
Absolutely. Jessie Sapleton nominated for Women's Under-19 International Player of the Year in the nominees for the FAI International Awards that were announced today. Speaking of the League of Ireland then, Rebecca, you've been tasked with, and Alan, I know you were keeping an eye on Shamrock Rovers P-Mount the other day as well, you've been tasked with giving a half-term report. So we're at the international break now, the All-Ireland Cup is coming up. So I suppose what's been the standouts for you overall? What's gone to form and what's surprised you perhaps so far?
Yeah, look, I think you start at the top, you know, there's no denying that P-Mount deserve to be where they are right now. You know, I think, as I've said, you know, many times on the show over the course of the last few months, they kind of slipped under the radar at the start, you know, with Rovers grabbing the headlines, you know, Shelves obviously chomping at the bit after having the success last year, and it's just, you know, gone in their favour completely. They've won it when it mattered most in games, you know, they've beaten the top teams, as they say, in the likes of Shelves recently, and obviously, you know, got that the win against Rovers there last week as well. They've also shown that they are beatable, you know. They can drop points. And I think, you know, if I'm P-Mount right now, I'm riding on the crest of that wave in the first half of the season. But we still have got that second half to go. So, you know, you never know what could happen. I'm pretty sure throughout the league, you know, there's tired bodies, tired minds. And they're all looking forward to this mid-season break. You know, looking back at Shells, it's been a bit hit and miss for them, you know, mediocre to say the least. It's been not the best, also not the worst, but I'm pretty sure they'll be looking forward to breaking after this All-Ireland Cup as well. You know, again, with Rovers, I'm pretty sure they'll be quite content. You know, they've been unbeaten until that P-Mount game, which I'm sure they've been raving about, and I'm sure they're disappointed as well, though, with the unbeaten run. But I think, you know, looking at Bowes, they've probably surprised me the most. You know, they've been knocking on the door the last few months or years, I should say, since coming into the league. You know, they look at the likes of Rachel Kelly has been immense for them. You know, she's kept them in many games and pulled off some fantastic saves, and obviously Sarah Rowe has added that little bit of spark for them as well, and you know, that showbiz spark, but she's done the business on the pitch as well. So it's been all round a good season. You know, I think if one team can look at it disappointingly, it's probably Wexford. Been, you know, a weird season for them. They've 5 losses across the season, which has been unheard of for them, you know.
Change of manager now as well.
Yeah, exactly. And look, that might be something that it might give them that little rejuvenation the second half. You know, everyone wants to impress a new pair of eyes coming in. And look, you never know what happens after the summer. They might kick on and take some important points off the top 2 or 3.
Yeah, absolutely. It is turning into kind of maybe top 4, top 5 if you include Galway, and then we'll see if Wexford do make a push after the break as well, with Athlone, DLR, who Laura Heffernan recently appointed there as well, and Treaty, Sligo and Cork looking for improved seasons. In terms of players, I saw the League of Ireland announced their half-term team with Rachel Kelly, who you mentioned, in goals, a back three of Murphy, Stapleton and O'Hanlon from Bowes, Shells and P-Mount respectively, Sarah Rowe, Karen Duggan, Sive Doyle and Jenna Slattery in midfield, and then it is O'Gorman, McKee and Gemma Quinn as well in a front three. Who's stood out or who's shone brightest, Rebecca?
Yeah, like looking at that, look, I don't think there's much I changed, to be honest with you. You know, again, I've mentioned Sive Doyle earlier in the season, earlier in the conversation has been fantastic. O'Hanlon again in there from P-Mount, Kelly, as you mentioned. I think there's one or two missing that I might have included myself personally. Maggie Pearce for Shelburne has been a wall at the back. You know, she's just one of those players that reads the game fantastically well. She can pick a pass as well, and can score goals. Another one is Kate Mooney at P-Mount. She's been brilliant in front of goal for P-Mount, you know, and I'm like, I'd probably slot her in there ahead of O'Gorman, you know, not taking away from Anya's season. But
big call,
she's
Becky.
Been enough,
big call.
She's been in enough team of the seasons, I think, or, you know, half team of the season, whatever you want to call it, yeah. Team of the half seasons over the years. But Kate has done really well, you know, and she's kind of improved so much over the years. I know Kate, and she's a young girl, and, you know, watching her in this season, it's probably been our best season so far. You know, she got a great hat-trick there last week as well. But, yeah, all in all, look, Jenna Slattery again at Galway, been carrying the team there at times with Lindsay McKee and Gemma McGuinness. I can't argue too much with it, but they'd be two that I probably would have included somewhere in there myself.
Okay. Alan, I mentioned you watched Piemont Rovers recently enough. Piemont now have a 6-point lead at the top of the table. Is it theirs to lose, in your opinion?
I think they deserve massive credit, because when you think of obviously the upheaval at the start of the season about losing some key players, they deserve huge credit, because the resources now that are available to clubs like Shamrock Rovers, Shelburne as well, it's probably getting harder and harder for Piemont. But to keep that group together and to perform in the manner that they have, and I watched the performance on Saturday to go to Tala, brilliant goal by Sive as well, Sive Doyle, fantastic finish. They've opened up a gap, 6 points, and it'll be interesting to see. But I think what's good from the women's point of view as well, Shane, is that there's 3, 4, 5 teams now in the mix rather than just one or two. And I know it's been a disappointing season, as Rebecca said, for Wexford, but if they can get back into the mix as well, all of a sudden you have 3, 4, 5 teams that could potentially win it. So that's good. The addition of Bowes has been massive as well. They've done really well, the Shamrock Rovers story as well, so I think that's all added to it. And it's on such an upward kind of trajectory, the women's game, domestically and internationally. It's great to see.
Absolutely. So the League of Ireland takes a break, but we do have the All-Ireland League. Rebecca, what should we expect from this? Is this team's kind of given maybe fringe players game time, or like, it's difficult to say how competitive this is going to be?
Yeah, most definitely. Look, I think it is probably time, as you said, to give those fringe players a bit of time. You know, maybe keepers that are sitting on benches will get in for these games and give them some minutes. It'd be interesting to see. I'm really intrigued to see what the teams north of the border are like against, you know, our own league down here. You know, you've obviously Glentoran are a really good side. You know, they actually beat Shells up in Belfast in the pre-season game up there. Cliftonville are second in there. You know, Glentoran are first. But that group B is looking like a tasty group, you know, with Glentoran and Wexford and Piemont and Rovers. So I'm sure that'll be the one that'll catch everyone's eye. It's going to be an interesting one. I think it's something that's maybe overdue as well. You know, it's not something we've ever seen in any of our leagues. So it'll be good to see how it plays out, and hopefully it's something that they continue on going forward.
Absolutely. To give just a roundup of those fixtures, this Saturday it all kicks off. Linfield, Galway and Athlone Shells are in Group A. Group B, it's Glentoran hosting Wexford Utes. Dublin Derby with Shamrock Rovers facing Piemont United at Tallaght Stadium in Group C. Derry City are away to Cliftonville. Sligo Rovers are at home to Bowes. And then in Group D, Crusaders host Treaty United and Cork City host DLR Ways. Rebecca Cray, thank you very much. Alan Colley, I'm going to give you the last word just before we round up our conversation, because a sad news today, and that is that former Scotland defender Gordon McQueen has passed away aged 70 after his battle with dementia. McQueen, whose 16-year playing career during the 1970s and 80s included spells of St Mirren, Leeds and Manchester United, was diagnosed with vascular dementia in early 2021. A statement issued on behalf of the McQueen family said, "It is with the heaviest of hearts we announce the passing of our beloved husband, father and grandfather. We hope that, as well as creating many great football memories for club and his country, he will be remembered for the love, laughter and bravery that characterised his career and his family life." A superb player. Some of our listeners, admittedly, I might have, you know, haven't seen much of him, obviously, for obvious reasons, but is superb, a legend of the game.
Yeah, he was around us, though, I suppose, in those days when Leeds were dominating as well, brilliant teams, and then at Man United. So heart on his sleeve type player as well, Shane. And as you say, he's been suffering through that illness, horrible illness, over the last few years. So 70 is no age as well. It's very, very sad. And as I say, it's there's a battle going on at the moment in the UK as well with former players, and obviously over the, there's, I suppose, a broader argument in terms of people who are suffering with that illness as well, and does it kind of feed back to when they were playing and were they looked after properly? It's hard to know, but I do know that there's a big case going on at the moment over there. Jeff Assel's family as well are fighting something similar, and I wonder, will the McQueen family kind of carry on that fight? But it's very, very sad news.
Absolutely, it's going to be back in the headlines, but our thoughts do go to Gordon McQueen's former teammates and indeed his friends and family. Alan Colley, thank you very much as always.
Pleasure, Shane.
We are going to be continuing our sports chat with a golf update later on, but up next we have Jeff Shepherd with his eye on America.
RTE 2FM.
Game on.
Eye on America.
Now, you're very welcome back to Game On. Jeff Shepherd is on the line live from the United States of America. Shep, how are you, pal?
I am great, Shane. How are you doing today, man?
I'm all the better for chatting to you. Let us dive straight in, sir, and start with a bit of basketball. Interestingly, I don't know if this is interesting or not. I like it's a little quirk. If you Google Denver Nuggets NBA, a load of fireworks appear on your laptop or your computer. So I enjoy those little quirks. So tell me, how did the Denver Nuggets get it done to win the NBA title?
Well, Shane, are you familiar with the phrase, and look, I don't know if this is just an American phrase or if this is, you know, translated into languages around the world, but are you familiar with the phrase, you know, if it looks like a duck and it walks like a duck and talks like a duck, it's a duck. You know, I mean, sometimes just the most obvious answer to the question is the answer. And how did the Nuggets do it? Well, it's Nikola Jokic. I mean, the guy was just, I mean, no one else has him on their team. I find it, you know, it was really interesting, you know, with the MVP race in the NBA this year. You know, it was it going to be Jokic or was it going to be Joel Embiid? And, I mean, you know, Jokic didn't get his third in a row for a variety of reasons. And, boy, he really just kind of made the folks who didn't vote for him look a little foolish, didn't he? I mean, he was just phenomenal in the playoffs. The stat that I saw that really kind of sums it up, he becomes the first player in league history to lead the postseason in points scored, rebounds, and assists.
Wow.
So he could clearly just, he's a master craftsman in the game of basketball. I mean, there is no facet of the game that he just doesn't, you know, have down pat. And so he carried the Nuggets. I mean, Jamal Murray was a really good number two on their team, a really great basketball player. But, I mean, how'd they do it? They had the best player at the best time, playing the best way he possibly could. And sometimes that's just too much to overcome.
Are you telling me he's underappreciated by some then? And maybe will this like clear all of that now?
Yes, I would hope so. I mean, you could see his teammates almost took it personally that he did not win the MVP. After most games, you know, the other players on the Nuggets that would do press conferences would get questions about Jokic, and almost all of them somehow worked in a phrase along the lines of, yeah, I don't know what you guys are looking at and why he wasn't the MVP. I mean, he's been doing this all season. You know, I mean, they kind of were just saying, like, really, guys? I mean, are we just not going to do this? I mean, we're going to come up with some excuse. And not to take anything away from Joel Embiid, he's phenomenal as well. But, I mean, clearly he's playing at a different level. You know, I think, you know, Shane, another interesting thing, you want to talk about just, you know, you get up, you go to work, you do your job, and, you know, you're successful. I mean, you know, Jokic gets asked after the final game, you know, about the parade, and he's like, no, I just want to go home. I don't really want to do a parade. You know, I mean, he's just very low-key, you know, and he's just, I don't care about the fanfare. I'm here to just destroy humans on basketball courts. That's what I'm here for.
That reminds you of Stephen Cluxton, who's a Dublin Gaelic footballer. When Dublin won the All-Ireland and everyone was celebrating like mad and everything else, and he scores the winning point and he just walked off into the dressing room. No, it's just, you know, just doing my job.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of memes floating around on social media right now, you know, of, you know, the post-game celebration. You know, the guys are all wearing goggles and they're shooting champagne all over themselves, and Jokic's just kind of standing in the corner, just like, hey, you know, we're at the club and all my friends are having fun and I'm just over here. You know, it's just, that's just kind of how he is.
Well, listen, more power to him. Talk to me then about what this also brings for Stan Kroenke, who a lot of people who follow the Premier League over here, obviously he's an interest in Arsenal, who came up short in the English Premier League. It was Manchester City who won the football side of things, but Stan is on a bit of a winning streak in US sports.
Yeah, he really is. And this is a real fascinating kind of piece to this whole championship for the Nuggets. So he also owns the Colorado Avalanche, who won Stanley Cup Finals last year. I believe it was their third cup. He owns a lacrosse team. He also owns the Los Angeles Rams, who, you know, we've talked about, you know, they were last year's Super Bowl champions before Kansas City won it again this year. So he has, you know, won a bunch of championships here in the last three or four seasons. And Shane, the interesting thing is, you know, he was one of the most reviled men in sports probably 5-6 years ago. You know, he moved the Rams from St. Louis to Los Angeles. But he had a vision about, you know, what he wanted to do and the stadium he wanted to have built in SoFi Stadium and all this. So he has really kind of been on both sides of it, you know, from a public relations standpoint here in the United States over the last couple of years. Moving a franchise in the United States, I mean, it's a big deal, you know, to do that. And he moves him from St. Louis, who really did nothing wrong, but he just wanted to be in Los Angeles. And now look at him. He's won a whole bunch of championships here in the last 36 months.
Yeah, it's amazing. Won't make for happy reading for Arsenal fans, but in 2017, Arsenal fifth in the Premier League, FA Cup finalists, Colorado Rapids bottom of the MLS Western Conference, Colorado Avalanche and Ice Hockey bottom of the NHL Western Conference, and basketball, the Nuggets were ninth in the NBA Western Conference, and American football, the LA Rams were third in NFC West. Then you fast forward to 2023, Rams Super Bowl, Colorado Mammoth, National Lacrosse League champions, the Avalanche Stanley Cup in 2022, Denver Nuggets now the NBA championship, and Arsenal, well, TBC. We'll see what next year holds for them. Listen, the final story I do want to pick your brain on is, well, listen, I'm just going to give you the floor. It's a reverse boycott, which is something I haven't heard of before.
Yeah, so it kind of goes in along the lines of, you know, moving a franchise. You know, we've talked on this show here in the last month or two about, you know, it looks like the Oakland A's are going to the Major League Baseball team. You have the San Francisco Giants, and then across the bay, you have the Oakland Athletics. And they have been a staple of Oakland for decades. I mean, they you know, were successful in the 70s and into in the 90s as well. But, you know, just not great attendance at their games. Their stadium is considered the worst in all of professional sports. And so, you know, the ownership wants a new stadium. They want the state and the city to pay for it. And that just hasn't been happening. And now Las Vegas is like, hey, come on down here. You know, we'll build you a stadium just like the Raiders did, you know, a couple of years ago. And so they're talking, you know, it seems like there's plans in the works that they're going to be moving to Las Vegas. So this week, the Oakland Athletics fans decided we were going to do a reverse boycott. And they went to a bunch of games. I mean, the attendance, like, quintupled from what they normally get. I mean, they've been drawing 5,000-6,000 people at a game, and they're pulling 27,000-28,000 this week. To basically, their point was, we're not the problem, ownership is. And so if we had a good product on the field, we would come and support this team. And they were chanting, you know, sell the team throughout the week. A lot of buy-in. You know, they got a lot of support in the media this week. Interestingly, Shane, the lead singer of Green Day, Billy Joe Armstrong, was pictured in the stands. Of course, Green Day is a Bay Area band, and so he is an Oakland fan, and he was there with the people out in the stands chanting for the owners to sell the team, to keep them in Oakland. Don't know if it's going to be enough, because Las Vegas is going to pay him a lot of money to move there, but we'll see how all this plays out.
Okay, well, as someone who's campaigned for saving a football ground here in Dublin, I'm all for people power, Shep. So hopefully we are successful, and hopefully the reverse boycott is successful as well. Listen, Jeff Shepherd, thank you very much for taking the call. Pleasure as always. We're going to stay stateside because Greg Allen is back with us to update us on the US Open. Greg, what has changed since we last spoke?
A little has changed. The relatively unknown Jacob Solomon, and this often happens in US Opens, you do get, you know, lesser known players shining early. He's the leader here on 4 under par after 15 holes, one stroke clear of a group on 3 under par, which includes Xander Schauffele and Ricky Fowler. Max Homa, very fine player, of course, likely to be on the US Ryder Cup team in Rome. He's 2 under after 9. Adam Hadwin of Canada in the group on 2 under par, and also going pretty well today, the likes of Bryson DeChambeau, 1 under after 10. Gary Woodland, 1 under after 10. And then the best of the Irish, Shane Lowry, just outside the top 20. But I wouldn't be too worried about where he is right now. It's the number he's at is the most important thing in terms of par. We all know that level par really is where you need to be in a US Open, and if you stay at that number come Sunday, you should be thereabouts and having a chance. And Shane Lowry is level par after 12 holes, and as I was saying earlier, that level par on the front nine, the courtesy of 3 pars, 3 bogeys and 3 birdies. So he's rolled in quite a few nice putts, and nothing very long, like 8 footers, 6 footers, 5 footers, but those are the ones that you you need to keep the score ticking over, and those are the ones that he hold. A 5-footer on the first got him under par figures, and an 8-footer on the 8th, and indeed a 6-footer on the 9th, one for birdie and one to save par, critical in keeping him at level par after 12 holes. So nicely for Shane Lowry so far. Matt McLean, the amateur, is actually just birdied the 8th hole, and that's the par 5. He's gone to level par after 8, so, and Seamus Power level par after 8 with a birdie just a moment ago on the 8th hole, the long par 5, daunting enough hole, and that really has given them a nice platform alongside Lowry, tied for 21st position. But there are plenty of players, you know, relatively notable names who've been struggling today, like Tyrrell Hatton, 2 over after 10 holes. We also saw Victor Hovland at 2 over par. Justin Thomas is 3 over par. Adam Scott is 3 over par. Jason Day in form this season on 4 over par. So plenty of players are struggling. John Ram, though, is not struggling in the world number 2. He is on 1 under par. And at the moment, Scotty Scheffler, I believe, if I'm just tracking back here, is on 1 over par. Victor Hovland, 2 over par. So plenty of players struggling. The trio of Irishmen on the golf course all on level par, going very, very nicely. Lowry after 11 holes, Power after 8 holes, and McLean after 8 holes. The leader, Jacob Solomon, on 4 under par, one stroke clear of that group, including Fowler and Schauffele, both on 3 under.
Great stuff. Greg Allen will be checking in with you plenty tomorrow, because we are on air until 10 p.m. A very special extended Game On with live commentary of Greece versus the Republic of Ireland. My final bit of golf news is good news. Olivia Mahaffey fired a great round 8 under of 64 to hold a one stroke lead at the end of the first day of the Amundi German Masters. So Olivia is going very well. Hopefully the Irish continue to go well at the US Open. Patrick Harrington is out at 9 p.m. and Roy McIlroy tees off at 9:55. Sinead, that is all we have time forward. The great Ben de Silva is up next with some banging tunes, but first we'll check in with the news desk after we take an ad break. But from all of the Game On team, it is bye for now.
RTE 2FM.